course of researching that, I came across an interview he did with another comic artist named Dan Shaw. And their conversation turned to, how do you deal with creating stuff for a reader? And they were on polar opposites in terms of how they think about it. Shaw said that he doesn't think about a reader. He creates a work of art and puts it out there. And whoever reads it, and they get from it what they get from it. And Mazzucchelli said that every page and every panel and every word that he puts on the page and every gesture, he's thinking about how somebody other than him is going to receive it. So, and this is for everybody, how do you deal with the reader or the person who's looking at the work that you produce? Do they play a role in how you think about how you're creating a comic?
All right, well, I think it's both ways. I mean, I think everyone is creating something for themselves. I mean, you're taking the time to do it, and a little piece of you is going to be part of everything you do. So in that aspect, I do create for myself, but at the same time, I want to share it with people. Like, I'm not just here to just put it in front of my face, like, or sit in the basement and work on it away from everyone else. I'm here to share my stories with everyone, and I really enjoy creating characters and letting other people enjoy that as well. With, you know, as many people, as many eyes can see it, then to me, like, that's a thumbs up. So I feel it works hand in hand. I mean, obviously you wouldn't be creating it if, like, it was only for you, if you're sharing it. So, I mean, there's certain things you want to keep personal, but I think as long as you're being public with it and you're sharing it, you want other people to see it as well. And in addition to that, basically the whole aspect of just having the internet and having a webcomic and just knowing that people in other countries can read it and anyone with an internet connection can read it is pretty amazing. And the technology that we have for that, I think, like, at you guys as students, like, I think that this is, you're living in a time period where this is pretty crazy. You can go out and just put anything out there, and who knows who will see it. I mean, Dave Navarro has seen Curls. So I know because he tweeted. You know, like, so it's like, I think that that's pretty awesome that you can reach out to whomever or whoever. You don't know who's looking at your stuff. So that's amazing. So for me, it is maybe, like, 10%, 15% for me. And I also use it as an outlet. I mean, if you're, you know, there's other things that could bog you down and you just have something inside of you that you want to release. And so I, in a way, even though I'm sharing it with other people, it's still for me. So maybe it's like 10 or 15% for me. And then the other is like, you know, hey, I want to share this with people.
I think that, like, doing as much work as I do for, like, illustration work for clients and stuff, and I don't really usually have that many bad ones who are super micromanagers or, you know, they say do whatever you want, but they don't really mean it. But usually the ones that I have are not too bad. But I am doing something for somebody else. Sometimes it's a good thing because they just say, draw this, and I don't even have to think about it. I just draw it, and, you know, it's just a job. The nice thing with comics, I do create stories that I would like to read, but I do also try to feel a responsibility to the reader to make things clear, because nothing kind of drives me crazy more than when the author doesn't respect the reader or the viewer or whatever enough to kind of, you know, make things make sense when they're just like, this is my art, and, you know, just take it. I think you can kind of walk the line and you can make something. I usually try to make comics that I would like to read. So, you know, I'm going to do the comics that I want to do, but I'm going to try to make them, you know, at least, I don't know, just respect the reader, whoever it might be.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. You do have to consider the reader if you're putting stuff out there. You can't just, I don't know, just make it a exquisite corpse of, like, this is everything I had in my brain today just because I wanted to get it out. You have to try to package it at least to, the least you can do is make it make sense, like you said, to somebody else. But you're trying to share your story, so you are doing it for yourself, but you want other people to come along and be involved in the ride because story is the most important thing. So
sometimes you can come up with something that you're just really like, oh, this is going to put asses in the seats. This is, people are going to like this, you know. But, you know, when you can, like, walk that line and you can find something that you're jazzed about working on, and you think that other people are going to like it too. I think that's a good way to approach it, I guess.
I know from myself, because the source material is fairly esoteric, and one of my personal mandates is to make sure that, you know, make all these epics, like, really accessible to anybody, whether they're 10 years old or 30 years old. So I generally write most of my work with very conscious of the reader in mind. And you can see that from my panel layouts. They're very straightforward, sort of panel-to-panel storytelling. I don't do a lot of crazy splash pages, A, because they're hard, and B, I think there's more of a risk of pulling the reader out of the narrative, and when they sort of are trying to figure out, well, where is that word balloon going? And so once you do that, you've lost that great magic, and which is very tenuous. When somebody cracks open your book, you want them from cover to cover. And so so when I'm creating, I really want to make it as clear as possible, because as I said, the source material is a little people think it's very weighty. So I kind of want to rip the patches off the tweed jacket and say, no, this is for everybody.
So. I don't know how much I have to add to that. I don't think you can write for everyone. So, and I think it's a little bit presumptuous to assume you can identify someone else's point of view and how they're going to interpret your work when you know every single detail about it, and the person that's reading it may not know anything. So that's a strange, you know, I think we all self-edit to some degree. You have to, or else you're not making anything. And in that self-editing, I think there's a certain level of what's clear and how clear is it in terms of how clear I want to be and things like that. But I don't know, it's a dangerous, I don't spend too much time worrying about it. I'm almost always surprised by reader reactions, so like the more work I do, the less I try to anticipate how the reader's going to react.
So kind of going along the line of writing for your audience, so I took the Honors Graphic Novel Seminar over the summer, and our professor, he always emphasized that don't try to figure out what the author was trying to say, focus on your own interpretation. So what's the most interesting interpretation of your own work you've ever heard from someone else, if you have that?
I don't know about interpretation. I know that it always kind of amazes me how, like, everything that you do is going to be someone's favorite. Like, I have had, like, a strip that I just thought was pretty crappy or terrible, and, like, almost immediately I'm ashamed I even let it out there. And yet somebody will tell me, like, that was their favorite thing. And it's just really odd that, you know, it was something that, like, yeah, well, I was frankly kind of, you know, embarrassed by. And that was my favorite story. So, you know, and that kind of goes to, like, not trying to guess the reader's reaction too much and just kind of do it. I mean, some things are just a misfire, and you know almost immediately that it was a misfire, but those things get out, so that would be probably honest.
Do you discount that reader's opinion then, or do you change your opinion of the work?
Well, no, I don't know, even know what I do. I just am just like, huh, how about that, you know? I mean, it really doesn't, I'm just kind of surprised, and, you know, it just kind of it just sort of proves that. I mean, because it's happened, you know, many times over many years that, you know, oh, they like that.
Well, do you ever reread your own stuff, like, a couple years later, and you're like, this is totally different from what I had in mind when I wrote it? Like,
yeah, I mean, I can sort of, like, I know what I was going for, but I can see that it didn't really work, you know? So, I don't know.
Do you ever revisit stuff that you didn't like and find you like it more now?
Not that I like it, but a lot of times I'm like, this isn't as bad as it seemed in my mind when I was, like, laying in bed thinking about it at 2 a.m. And there are times when I really am like, oh, that wasn't so bad. Because a lot of times, you know, like, I'm in a rush to finish something, and, you know, it's done, and I'll print it and go, and then I don't look at it again for a while. And then, you know, when I do, I'll, you know, be like, oh, that wasn't as bad as, you know, it could have been. So sometimes.
Yeah, I think we're probably all artists are generally our harshest critics. So there are times when I'll crack open the book and I'll read a couple pages like, oh, that turned out better than I mean, it still reads a couple years later, and yeah, the artwork is not as good as it could have been, but the story seems to flow. In terms of interpretation, I'm just thrilled that somebody's actually reading the book. So, and there are some folks who glom on to different characters, like little side characters where they were just an extra, and they kind of want to know about, you know, what's their story, and so it's always great to hear reader reaction and to see what elements of the book people are taking to, and what they want to see more of.
So. And when you're creating, you have to realize that not everyone is going to like everything that you do. Like, there's not one thing that everyone is going to gravitate towards. So, like, Joe and I, when we go to conventions, we have our tour, we have our table set up, it's really interesting to see what people pick up or what people buy and what people gravitate towards, because it's all over the board. Like, we have a whole smorgasbord of stuff on our table. We have mini comics for, like, $1 that we Xeroxed and, you know, Xeroxed, folded ourselves. And then we have stuff that, you know, it looks nicer, is made by print on demand and color, you know. Like, we have all these levels of, like, publishing, and it's interesting because at some places, like Pittsburgh, for example, they seem more into, like, the mini-comic scene. So, you know, people will gravitate towards that. And then if you go to a show like New York Comic Con, everyone's going to want to see something glossy and color, more professional looking. But it's just interesting going to all the different shows, from indie shows to, like, I guess the most highest level show we've been to is New York. And it's just interesting just seeing, and then at New York, some people, I was telling Monica earlier, some people are like, what's a mini comic? And I'm like, you're at New York Comic Con. So they've never been to, like, an indie show. They don't realize maybe, like, the first step of making a comic, going to Kinko's and Xeroxing it and making it yourself. So I just think that that's pretty interesting, the interpretation of that. Maybe that's not the story, but it's interesting to see different people and what you, and also as a seller behind the table, it's as a creator, it's also like, what do you think this person will like? You have people walking by your table and you ask them what they're into, and then I try to recommend something that they would be into. So I think it's also interesting to have different types of books at your table and different price points, so that if somebody just wants to try something out for $1, they can. If they want to go hardcore, then they can too.
I have a question for Jim Rohn specifically. You said that you did a lot of single panel strips, and I was wondering if there was anything sort of lost either for the reader or for yourself in changing genres, which inevitably will happen far more when you have changing subject matter. That's part one. Part two is, do you expand or reduce your audience in having the single panel strips? Do you have, like, a different forum for where people might see it? You said you showcase some of those images in galleries. You know, it's not, does it become something other than, say, a comic book because of the form in which you publish it?
Okay. Well, the first part of your question, you're asking if it changes audience by having different genre. So, I haven't shown these in a lot of places. Like, they've been appearing in there have been, like, alt tabloid newspaper anthologies that have sprung up around the country, and they've appeared in a number of those, including Magic Bullet from the Washington, D.C. area. So I don't know, you know, I think that's a relatively different audience than exists in the comics direct market, for example. I'm excited by that. Like, I like the idea of having people that aren't that familiar with comics seeing the work. You know, like, whenever I do something with McSweeney's for a cookbook, to me that's great. That's a chance to put comics in front of people that probably don't typically read comics, and I find that really exciting. Something with, you know, VH1 and a lot of the non-traditional outlets, and I kind of see these big single pages as a similar thing. I see it putting it in galleries as a similar thing, but it's really hard for me to say who's actually reading them and who's seeing them. You know, you hear from a very, very small percentage. I would guess way less than 1% of the people that see them, you know, get feedback from. So I don't know how that affects the audience. And most of that stuff's like trial and error stuff. You know, realistically, it may never go beyond my drawing table and a few people that see it in one of these newspapers. So how that ultimately finds an audience remains to be seen.
What was the second part of your question?
The second part was whether it expands or reduces your audience, in your opinion.
I feel like the direct market, it's very hard to tell how many people are actually involved with comics through the direct market, or even through the book market. And to me, you have maybe 100,000 people or so interacting with comics through a very specialized small market. And you have 6.5 billion people outside of that market. And it amazes me that everybody's elbowing each other to fight for that 100,000 people market, where to me it's like I gladly target the other 6.5 billion people and let you guys fight over this. You know, I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with comics that would prevent them from reaching any audience that film might appeal to or any audience that literature might appeal to. So to me it's like put the work in front of as many people as possible and, you know, trust the readers. One thing that I've found with my readership is I think they're really intelligent. Like, the feedback I get often surprises me. It's often insightful. People find little details that I kind of feel like I'm amusing myself, putting into the pages or whatever. And then that'll be the first thing, you know, a number of people bring up to me. And it's like, oh, wow, you guys are much more astute than I am as a reader. So, you know, I feel like I trust putting the work out there and letting readers find it and react to it on their own, however they want. I think that you could have the greatest marketing push behind your work in the world, and ultimately that's not going to make the work good or bad. You know, somebody's going to read the work and decide for themselves whether they like it or not. And I think people are able to find work now in ways that just didn't exist 20 years ago.
Couple of thoughts and questions. First of all, I'm immensely impressed with all of your work. I was one of the people who read, Jen, who said you started reading comics when most of your friends stopped. I was one of those friends. I read for a bit and sort of kind of got away from it. But watching all this, a number of questions are springing to mind. I'll start with your work, just to return to that sort of single panel, caught in the middle, you're not sure what the narrative is. Because that makes me think about sort of a couple things. Why am I blanking on the artist's name? I've got a PhD in art history, and what's his name? Come on. Dots, Bende Dots.
Lichtenstein?
Lichtenstein, Roy Lichtenstein. I wanted to say Rauschenberg. I knew that, but Roy Lichtenstein. I see that somewhere between Roy Lichtenstein and an Abe cartoon. The reason I say an Abe cartoon is because I was really struck by when you zoomed in. Sort of the thing that you never think about, and you never see in the comics, is the aftermath, the normal, what happens. And I wonder if you might sort of, particularly given the Rambo 3.5, which seems to me kind of an extended op-ed in a way, because we talked about your response to 9/11, you might sort of talk about how your work, and then you just sort of talked about your sort of concern with that 100,000 person market, but you're just sort of working out your own ideas. But if this is a panel sort of thinking about the traditional idea of a comic book and situating it in the broader sort of academic world, place some of what you're doing, or really all of them seem to, within the broader academic academy, as it were, the English department, the art industry department, all that.
You know, it's really hard for me to do that. I don't think a critical vernacular has formed yet for comics. A lot of people, whenever I read art, comics criticism will often break the narrative into two components. They'll talk about the story and they'll talk about the art, and that's not really addressing what comics are. Because at an early age, I read a comic by Chester Brown who draws in a somewhat primitive old newspaper style. He's sort of an underground alternative cartoonist, and I remember reading it at the time whenever I mostly read X-Men and things that were very polished and over-rendered and melodramatic. In reading Chester Brown's work, I was struck by, it was a very powerful story about him being a teenager and sort of starting to date girls and things. And the artwork, like, I recognized it wasn't the artwork that I usually liked. It wasn't this labored over style, but it fits so perfectly with the story, you know, and I recognized, like, this wouldn't work with, like, the artist that I think of as my favorite cartoonist. They wouldn't be able to draw this story and have any impact. So it's hard for me to classify where my work would fit academically, or almost where any cartoonist's work would fit academically outside of somebody like perhaps Robert Crumb, you know, who you could situate in like a post-pop setting. You know, it'd be like trying to say, where does some filmmaker fit within like a painting history? You know, I think it's a distinct form, and you know, we need to develop the language. And quite frankly, the development of academic support around comics, I think, is a great thing. I think it will enhance the form's development immensely, but I also think it's in its very early stages, and it makes it hard to sort of have a unified discussion about it.
Excuse me, I have to actually agree that there is that component of academic and the comic genre. And from my brother's work, I think the Beowulf, Son of Roland, and then Seed would work very well in teaching poetry to high school age. It depends, you know. It depends.
There are a handful of cartoonists there.
I think his work is perfect.
There are a handful of cartoonists that are very much in line with poetry as, you know, probably a closer correlation to their work than, say, literature.
Right.
Like Warren Craighead and Austin English, I don't know if you know these guys, but they do work that's very much in that vein. And, you know, it's amazing as a reader to see that, but it is complicated to try to sort it out and write about it.
Well, one of the things about, I mean, Abram and I discussed the titles, and I sort of, knowing not very much about comics, you know, I was like, wait a minute, isn't there just jump between panels? And so I started throwing things at him. Hopefully he won't tell you the other things I said, but they're all pretty bad. But although he came up with one that had gutter in it, he said that probably wouldn't be so good.
You're asking about like technical language for comics.
Yeah. But the ability visually to skip around is so key to comics as opposed to any other sort of visual form. That's very distinctive about comics, and I've been thinking about poetry the whole time, and I think especially with, you know, Beowulf, you were inspired by Beowulf, mm-hmm. AP English, I'm thinking, my goodness, my daughter used AP English this year, you know, just sitting there, might she encounter, you know, a poetic form and then be inspired? Probably not. but nonetheless, I'm inspired by that, the way you sort of went in that direction. Then I thought, well, wait a minute, and I'm probably going to buy Kid Beowulf for my kids to take back, so I'm undercutting my own argument. But do I want someone to learn about Beowulf from comics?
That's a great point. And I would really be afraid if kids only read this and thought that Beowulf and Grendel were twin brothers. Because that's, you know, I want to point people back to the source material.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So that is a... for lack of a better word, that's sort of a dangerous proposition on my part to really twist the.
But it's,
the
it's wonderful fruit of the inspiration that you, when you were in AP English. I mean, I love that story.
Yeah, and there's lots of criticism out there that they, you know, I've read people say like Beowulf and Grendel are more similar than, you know, as a pair than many of the other characters that they interact. So there's that duality of, you know, monster and monster slayer that sort of rolls over through myth, and that was sort of the compelling thing to me that, you know, you see the likenesses in Harry Potter and Voldemort and, you know, Luke and Vader, and it's just sort of one of those mythological strands that gets played with over and over. For me, a lot of it is just, this is just like starter material. I really want people to, you know, if they're done with reading my saga, they go and see how it ends and read Beowulf or Song of Roland or what have you.
I don't think that'll ever be a concern that one would replace the other. They're all very distinct.
Yeah.
It's like when people are afraid that movies will replace books. That's never going to happen. They're always going to be their own separate take on the same general subject matter, and then what they do with it specifically is completely different and can be completely wonderful in its own right. So,
and even like, you know, it sounds like people that are reading these are pretty educated, so they're going to go back to the source material and know about that. Like, even with Wiccan and Wizard of Oz, like, that is, like, to me, the perfect example of taking source content, twisting it, making your own stories out of the same characters, and, you know, and people are intelligent enough to know what is the difference.
Let me ask you, Jim, though, because I don't know if maybe I misinterpreted your initial question, but in terms of aphrodisiac, like when you're at the table telling people what it's about, how do you categorize it? Because it's sort of its own historical, you know, you mentioned that it sort of came out of a black exploitation.
I asked them if they are familiar with Black Dynamite.
Okay.
And if they say yes, it's all
sold.
It depends. It depends how interested they are. They usually ask me, and then I just try to answer whatever questions they have, as opposed to like the pitch.
Right.
It's tough because I would think that there are just a couple pages in there, you know, maybe a couple separate, you know, just a one page, and you can read it and I like this, you know, like, because honestly I don't have that much of that, you know, experience. I haven't seen a lot of blaxploitation films. I mean, I'm sort of amorphously aware of it as a genre, but I'm far from an expert. But you know, just it works on such a different level. I mean, almost all you need is just to know that there was that genre to at least enjoy it, I thought. Because it's just so damn funny.
I have, the longest conversations I have with people at the table are, like, a graphic designer that will be like, oh, how did you do this color?
So I end up talking about it. Like this.
So yeah. It's different for everyone.
I think that goes through.
It really helps to look so good. It really does. I mean, there's not, you know, you can talk about, like, your, you know, like, again, about the whole, like, working for the reader or whatever, but, I mean, you clearly put great care into making it look the way it does. Everybody here clearly takes great care into making things look the way they do and thinking about format and thinking about, I mean, I love how, like, the, the books are tall, you know, like, the tall, and just, you know, different formats and different sizes and all that sort of thing. And I think that, you know, goes a long way just to, just respecting your audience.
That's sort of a bit of a segue because you're talking about like the highly rendered art. And there are certain types of comics, notably like web comics like XKCD, that are almost, they're practically stick figures. When XKCD, the only detail sometimes is a hat. And there are other cartoons that are as ingredient or as a form. Do you think that those are different? Some fundamental way by being less sort of artistic and creative and being more just sort of almost, I don't want to say abstract, but almost they're sketchy.
Are you familiar with Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics?
Yes.
He creates that picture frame, you know, where like photographs are one point, which would be, you know, a super realistic two-dimensional rendering, with the alphabet, I think, is like the other kind of point of that, where it becomes like so abstracted, you know, somewhere like Peanuts is moving closer to letter forms where two dots signify eyes, you know, and just a circle's a head or whatever. So I think it's all related. You know, there are definitely degrees.
I think Scott McCloud is defining a sort of academic sphere for that stuff.
No. Do you personally like that? Like, I have not read Is it
XKCD?
Okay, because it personally it affronts me as an artist. I mean, just because visually, which is really shallow of me to say, but I'm just drawn to the visuals of comics and to see the line work and to see the artistry in it. So, you know, forgive me, I haven't actually read it. I know of it because it's insanely popular webcomic and very successful, but I just can't engage with it because visually it's so off-putting. So I didn't know if you guys had
it's all preference. I mean, like Scott McCloud said that, you know, you may identify more with things that are a lot simpler. Because I have a lot of trouble reading anything that's like really, really detailed. And there's just like lines everywhere. It drives me crazy. I feel like there's no part for me in the story. Like I can't even get in there. So I think there's probably a lot of people who have a lot more to identify with if it's really simple. And they don't really need to consider like, oh my gosh, this person is an amazing artist. Like it doesn't even make them like come across that. They don't have to worry about it. They can just enjoy whatever they want out of it.
I think it's like almost on a case-by-case basis, because I haven't seen actually the strip in question. I know one of the ones that I always liked is Akewood, and it's super simple, just, you know, pretty much the character, it almost looks like clip art, but the jokes are good, and, you know, and it completely pulls me in. You know, you can hear the characters talking in your head and everything. It's just, everything really works, even as simple as it is. Whereas then you take somebody like, I think his name's Tony Harris. He's a artist. I know he's worked on some books that I've liked in the past, but I tried to read, I think it's like called Ex Machina or something like that. And it was so obviously photo referenced. It was so like ridiculously like hyper, you know, real looking in a way that I just couldn't even finish it. It just, I don't know. Maybe it's Uncanny Valley or something like that. But I mean, it wasn't even that bad. But it was just, you could, it just seemed so much like he was drawing from photos or whatever. It just completely took me out of it. Yeah, I don't know. I think it just kind of depends on the work, you know, how well it all meshes together. I mean, if the art is simple and the writing is lousy, then it's probably not going to work. But if the art is simple and the writing is really good, then it's just another piece of language.
I think it's also, like, the way it communicates, like, even in fine art, I forget the artist who did this, but there is an art that I used to make fun of that's called, like, white on white, and it's white paper with a white piece of paper on top of it. That's literally what it is. And I asked my teacher, I was like, what is this? Like, it's kind of like the equivalent of seeing a stick figure. It's like, oh, this is a stick figure cartoon? Like, you know, did you take at least a little bit more effort to put more detail or something on it? But I was like, what is up with this white on white? Like, what makes this so special? And the teacher was like, well, this was the guy, he did it. You know, does anyone know who the artist? I'm sorry.
Kandinsky.
Was it Kandinsky? Okay. I'd have to check my art history. But I'm not sure if he was a painter. I just remember it was white on, and then it's like you could barely see a difference of like another piece of white on top of it. And like to me at first, I was like, this has no thought in it. Why would somebody just do a white, like blank, pretty much a blank piece of paper? And so my teacher was like, well, he was the first person to do that. He did that. So basically, to me, if you're out there making cartoons, whether it be stick figures or more photorealistic, I mean, it's all personal preference of what you would gravitate towards. Like, how many of you are probably going to be at SPX tomorrow? Raise your hand. Okay, so like half me. You know, when you come tomorrow and this weekend, basically, you're going to see a whole load of stuff. And, you know, there is Matt Frizzell. He does stick figures too. I don't know if he's going to be there tomorrow, but he does stick figure stuff too, but he has more detail in his. But it's almost like you can see the whole range of things, and I just think it's a credit to the people that create it. Like, white on white. Somebody made that. Somebody thought of that. Like, other people, like, I could have thought of that, but I didn't make it. So then when you see something, have you ever thought of a great idea and you see something, you're like, oh my gosh, I wish I made that. Like, I could have done that. Or I already thought of that 10 years ago. You know, like, why didn't I make it? But the thing is, you didn't do it 10 years ago. There's been several times where I'm like, oh my God, I just had that. But I didn't make it. I wasn't the first. You know, it's like an internet message board, first. You know? Like, I think that matters, though. Like, you have to be the first on it. You have, and I mean, even though I'm not, like, I've seen that XKCD. I've been to the website a couple times. I've seen it. I haven't read it, but you know, it's almost like some people can appreciate that if they are into the writing, and obviously it's super popular. There's got to be at least something there. I mean, everyone's heard of it at least. So I give, you know, whoever created that a lot of credit to that extent. But then I do also appreciate people that take time to make things look visually stunning, and we're all into art here, so I think on top of that, like, it adds an extra value to the storytelling if your art at least, you know, has some more punch to it than just a stick figure. That's me personally.
There are things that I don't like that don't work for me, but they, you know, they work for somebody. I don't like just immediately discount them just because they don't work for me.
Yeah,
you know?
That's what I'm saying. There must be something to these popular stuff.
I mean, it's not the same as like, well, Transformers 3 made $100 billion. It must be something good. No. But a lot of times, like, especially like for comics, and there'll be things that, you know, are not necessarily my cup of tea, but somebody is getting something out of them, and there's sincerity behind it.
Yeah.
I don't know how you measure sincerity, but
if you have that many people talking about it, and that, like, your exposure level is that high, like, there must be people keep coming back, and the storytelling or jokes or whatever the message you're getting out is obviously working. So I credit that.
You interpret these those drawings too differently in your brain. There was a French neuroscientist published a book, I think last year, called Reading in the Brain, and it talks about the way we disassemble letter forms in our brain, and then like the pathway through our brain, and then they're reassembled, and then we form more, you know, like we recognize those as words. And the drawings are that way. Like, I don't read Marvel comics anymore, and I think it's because the pictures are so highly rendered that they look like a photograph, like Monica was saying. It's very specific, but it's also very different than reading a word balloon. So, like, the in your brain, you're really taking two opposite pieces of visual information and trying to make them make sense, and I just am unable to do that smoothly. So it's hard for me to read those books and really read them and be, like, involved in them, as opposed to somebody like Jason, the Norwegian artist that's very simple, that has a very simple style. You know, and his drawings are practically extensions of the letter forms because he has like four sets of eyes that every character is going to have one of these eyes. But it allows you to, like, as you're reading, you almost read faster and faster as you're going. Like, it really becomes a complete world and you're locked
in. And
his
stuff is so, like, it can shatter.
It's very effective.
I mean,
yeah.
It can absolutely shatter. Like, hey, wait, I mean, that book is just, it's as powerful as any comic I've ever read.
Right.
And just with, so, if you know what you're doing.
Another thing that's amazing with that is, with, like, super photorealistic stuff, I feel like I appreciate it, and I'm like, oh, I read some of those books, I'm like, this is really great art, it's nice. Like, something like Alex Ross, like, is really great artist. And then, like, you can see that, but then I almost don't make up things in my own head for it. I just accept it to be like, okay, I'm reading this, and it looks almost like a photo. But then, you know, maybe with stuff that doesn't quite have backgrounds, or stick figures, or just black and white, when you're, as a reader, like you're saying, you make stuff up in your head, maybe when you're drifting through the story, you can kind of, like, add colors, add your own stuff into it. So maybe that's a, you know, a positive for stuff that's more simplified. So you jump into that own world, and everybody can interpret it their own way. I mean, a lot of comic strips don't even have backgrounds, but you know that they're in a library. But you know that just because of the story. And they could just be holding maybe one book. But it's interesting how your brain can piece all those ideas together.
Yeah, this is going in a completely different direction, but comic books still have a big stigma for women, particularly. Do you guys try to address that, bring in women audiences, or do you just not worry about it and leave that to your marketing people, or what?
Wish I had a marketing person. I think it's kind of like Jim said, it's just about reaching the audience, like, you know, anyone, because, like, I don't want to make my stuff appeal to everyone necessarily, but I would like to reach as many people as I can that might be interested in it. And it's funny because at comic conventions, oftentimes I have more men buy my stuff than women, even though I consider what I do fairly, like, bright and girly in some respects, because there's a lot of pink. So it's interesting. I'm not going to necessarily change what I do because I think it'll appeal more towards either gender, but I think it's interesting, like, who comes back and ends up reading it.
I mean, I think the best thing to do is just do a good job. I mean, if you tell a good story, it's not necessarily, you know, targeting anyone. It's just you're telling a good story.
Right.
Although, kind of the on the other side of what you said, Monica, like, I do, you know, a lot of pinup stuff too. Like, a lot of my Savage Love illustrations sort of, you know, kind of taught me that I can draw, you know, naked people pretty well. And I got into doing like pinup art and stuff like that. And it, you know, and that is one thing that is always pretty successful and people like it. And a lot of women like it too. And, you know, like, more than I would think. And I think it's because I try not to be crass or whatever, usually keep things kind of playful and light. But I'm always kind of surprised by how, you know, just everybody responds to that. Everybody responds to, like, Gil Elfgren. It's just, you can't not, like, think it's cute and like it. But as far as comics, I mean, if you write a good... I mean, I don't know how many women are interested in comics about hockey players, but if it's a good enough, you know, if it's an interesting story, then, you know, it's just like, you know... I don't know many women that are, like, boxing fans, but they like Ali, or, you know, or... Well, that's a bad example. Raging Bull, maybe, you know, but yeah.
What is the stigma that you're referring to? Because that I'm surprised to hear you say that. I feel like the industry has really improved vastly in the last 15 years.
Well, it definitely has improved, but I know a lot of women who just won't. They buy their comics online rather than go into the comic shops and that sort of thing.
I know
so
a lot of men that do that as well. That's
yeah.
I don't know if that would make
well,
that a
they
a
do it
gender
because they're
issue.
Uncomfortable in the comic book shops.
That's what I'm referring to.
Yeah, well, that aspect's always going to be kind of a boys' club, though. You know, I mean, it just depends on the shop, too. I mean, I know some really good. There's some really good ones. And really
I don't, it's funny too. Like, there's this great comic book store in Baltimore that I just met the owners, and they look like. Well, I have an uncle who looks like them, but they're these giant guys with these huge beards, and they just wear heavy metal shirts all the time. And they're the most soft-spoken sweethearts ever, and all they do is organize like. As many events as possible to get like more and more wider audiences, like kids and old people.
I do think American comics, though, and by that I mean the big two, DC and Marvel, traditionally, male adolescent fantasies, which I grew up reading those, and I find that I don't know if there are a lot of really compelling stories there for people who aren't thinking they're male adolescents in those two companies. I just don't read them anymore because it's the same story over and over again. So, and I know that in my own work there's a challenge because a lot of these stories are ancient, so they're about men fighting, which is similar to DC and Marvel stuff. So, I try and find a compelling female character to bring something feminine to the story and address that component because I think it is pretty important to get all readers, female and male. If that's the stigma you're referring to, I would agree with you. I think in terms of what's readily available, it's you sort of have to dig for it because of the clamor of those types of stories.
I think women also on their own need to go out and find the books that they like. Because, even if you go to SPX tomorrow, like a lot of the girls that are there are creators. Like, I don't know the percentage, but it seems like it's almost 50-50. There's a lot of women behind the table there. And there are women creators, and there are women readers, and I really don't think that there's any bias. It's more of like the women might only see certain things that they want to see, but there are totally books for them out there. Like, go tomorrow and you'll find stuff for you.
Just before your question, I am an outsider, but I'm just looking around the room. It's more women here than men. So I suspect most people here are that are going out to a home and they're bored with it. Maybe that's what we're talking about. But in a panel discussion about comics, art, Christian culture, everything like that, I'm just struck by the fact that it's unscientific. Right.
Yeah. I do think it's better once you leave Marvel and DC in terms of, percentages of women creators and fans and readers and stuff. And I don't know. I mean, I feel like it's improving. It's probably definitely not 50-50 at this point. But whenever I started doing shows in the late 90s and like around 2000, it was all men. I can remember doing like indie shows and being like, wow, there are like normal looking women at this show. It was shocking. I remember going into like a bookstore, like a chain bookstore, when manga became very popular in the early 2000s, and seeing like junior high school age girls sitting, reading these books, and it was just like the Twilight Zone compared to coming from a comic book shop background, So I think it's getting better, and I think as long as you have very good women cartoonists creating very good comic books, which you have right now, it's role models for young aspiring women cartoonists. It's content for people who just want to read comics that aren't male-centric. So, it's a positive cycle. Like, it's improving. I think it's constantly improving. I think it's at a very good level now, already. So, I guess a guy saying that doesn't mean as much. But it's an issue that has been, people have been talking about, I think, for the last 10 or 15 years, and I think it is moving.
Yeah, I think it's definitely been addressed, and it's, like you said, moving in the right direction almost. I mean, it's almost kind of to the point where, there's always going to be superhero comics that are for just, adolescents or overgrown adolescents, but I think there's plenty for young men.
For 40-year-old men with their
40-year-old. I remember, like, I was just thinking how I remember going to, I think it was Chicago Comic Con, like 1994 or 95, and being able to, like, the pictures I took at the show, like, oh, there's the girl.
Right.
There she is. That's the one.
That's the one.
And all the photos, just the one, like, it was bizarre. Thinking back about it now, it's just like, but I clearly remember it.
That must have sucked for her.
Oh, man. It had to be bad.
Yeah, I'm really interested in kind of the autobiographical trend that seems to be running through your work. And, I mean, especially along the lines of what we were talking about just art style and representation. I'm just really interested in what the medium does for you autobiographically, especially in terms of, like, talking about boobs and self-esteem. Like, what does this form do for you that other forms do not?
I think, well, since you brought up boobs. I think it helps, at least for me, get my point across, because obviously I tend to think visually, and I can put in, like, a lot of this is from memory, so a lot are just, like, snapshots of what I remember a situation looking like in my head, and trying to get that across. But I also think that it's much more accessible when there are pictures and faces that you can read and situations you can interpret yourself as a reader rather than just me trying to explain everything that I was feeling just with text.
Do you mean, like, doing it as comics as opposed to in another form?
I mean, just in terms of, like, self-representation, like when you have that control over whether you want something to look like a photo or whether
right.
you want it to look like a line drawing, like...
Gotcha.
That's kind of tough, because there are different artists will do different things. Like, there's a lot of cartoonists who draw themselves completely differently from how they look in real life. It's really interesting to see, like, what they're comfortable with.
Yeah, I was reading True Story, Swear to God, if you guys... You know, it's
yes.
a good comic by this fellow Tom Beland, and he has a very cartoony style, and he writes really well. And I, on the back of the comic cover, there's a photo of him, and I looking back and forth between his representation of him and what he actually looked like, and it didn't look at all like himself. There's really not an answer there, just sort of an observation.
Yeah, but
I'm
interested.
Yeah, his wife actually did look more like her cartoon version. That's always fascinating to see.
When I started doing autobiographical strips, I just wanted to do strips. I just needed, like, something to just to do a comic about, and I kind of fell into that, and I just liked it. It was just kind of fun. It was fun to kind of try to come up with something that you could, readers could relate to. That was a good example of, those strips where I could do a strip and they'd say that was their favorite one because, it was just like something I just had an idea and, did it. And somebody really, connected with that. And so that was cool. It was just a great way to get, just ideas across and, and spout off about something now and then, or try to tell a joke, or it's a nice kind of a catch-all way to just, when you have no real, when there, you can just, it's just kind of like a blank slate, you can do whatever you want, you can tell a funny story, you can, there actually was a period of time, like in the late 90s when I was pretty depressed, and I go back and I look at, like, the comics I did then, and they're dark, man. They're really like, what the hell must people think? And they pick up their, like, free weekly and they're like, oh, look, he's still alive. So that is a little weird, too. But and it's kind of cool to have as a record, too, of a time. Like, I really wish that I have two kids now. We just had a baby back in May, and I have a 4-year-old. And I really kind of wish that, like, if I was a good businessman, I would have done a comic all about, the pregnancy. First, and having a kid, and then I thought, well, maybe the next one, and then I missed it again with the second one, because I just didn't really want to do that book. But there are things, but I think it would be popular, like I think people would be into something like that, and that is a good example of, like, what we were talking about before, about reaching the other, 6.9 million people, or whatever, billion people in the world, to be like, this is just a story about something that you can relate to, because you're a parent and it's, you know, or whatever.
Well, because you never see a pregnant body in Marvel comics.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, it's just, yeah, it's not even, bodies. Why even worry about those people? I mean, the hockey could have sort of, you know, I mean, there are not that many, there are tons of hockey fans, you know, and there's a whole country called Canada. So you can target that sort of, but anyway, just, you know, if I'd been thinking and if I was like a shrewd business man, I would have been like, you know, writing all this stuff down. As it was, it's just bits and pieces, but it would be really nice to just go back to it and look at it as like a historical record of, you know, like that year in my life or whatever. It's fascinating to go back and look over stuff like that.
You answered it on your own.
Yeah.
Okay.
Based on the advice.
So as far as like the thought development process that you go through before you produce a comic, would you say you spend more time thinking about the actual story or about the art in the way you present that?
It's combined. At least for me, I don't write a script separately. I have to do everything like thumbnails all together. And then progress from there, but it's always like together. They're holding hands. They're walking the whole way.
I do a script separately, and I try to spend as much time as I can breaking the story, doing the research, and then taking that to the finished page. And often, my drawing self is cursing my writing self because, you know, write these big sequences. Because, you know, you're just writing, you're just typing. I'm like, yeah. 20 people in this panel with lots of horses, and I do that. And you get there, and you realize, oh, there's a problem here, and I have to sort of figure out a way to translate what I've written to the page. So I should probably find a better way to maybe walk in the hand-in-hand thing that can help me. For me, it's the drawing is really the. The penciling is tough, but the writing is for me the hardest part, and I can sort of breathe when I get to the drawing table.
Yeah, I kind of do sort of like Monica, just kind of start. I usually have a vague idea and I'll write a few things down and just sort of, you know, hash things out as I go, you know, like back and forth to the thumbnail, you know, what's going to be in this panel, how's this page going to be laid out or whatever. I always kind of struggle with page layout, you know, like trying to come up with something interesting without overdoing it and all that kind of thing. So I think I usually kind of err on the side of boring, but yeah, that's all.
Clarity.
Yeah.
Sometimes a story can just hit you, and you know, you're walking to class or something, or you're like, oh my gosh, that'd be so great, write it down real quick. And then, like, for me, like, doing the breakdowns, or even when I get a script from Joe, too, it's like, you know, everything is laid out by page, and then, like, when I'm breaking down the story, like, if you think about comics in general, it's like, here you have this book, whether it be, like, whatever, 32 pages or 28 pages or whatever, X amount of pages, that is like one encompassing thing. Then there's like a circle inside of that circle that's like maybe each chapter if you have that. And then there's like another circle that's like each page spread. And then if you get down to that each page, and then the like littlest tiny circle is like that panel. So you're thinking about things on like this global aspect of like each image, and not, it's not just one image. And so breaking down the entire story like that is pretty intense. I mean, I don't know how else I can relate to, like, but basically a circle within a circle, and just thinking all those parts through, and making sure it works as one giant whole, you know, and then as it works within each one of those other circles, the elements are intense to break down, but once you figure that out, pretty much the art can, I mean, with me, like, I just have to do it, and then it'll be freeing, and the art is the fun part anyway. I mean, I don't know about you guys up here, but I feel like that's the fun part. And not, I mean, doing the story when you first like have like that like connection of, oh, this would be great, you know, like this idea, this fragment of a story is really great, and that's fun too. But for me, like breaking it all down is the hardest part.
That's the solving the puzzle.
Yeah.
Right. You have to sort of just make everything work, and it's always kind of a rush when you figure it out. You're like, here, and it all fits together. It's nice. But yeah, it's like a riddle.
It's actually like the thinking behind it. It takes so much energy and like pain, actually, sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, making comics is fun, but at the same time, like, you're really, like, solving that problem can be painful, and you're not even physically moving your body. like, it's not like I'm doing, like, a marathon, but, like, in my brain, like, who knows what's going on up there, you know? like, so, it's a good struggle, though.
Yeah, I've been staring at a blank screen that you're supposed to finish writing the script for all this morning, all before this thing, I've been trying to just write a scene and nothing. I mean, I knew it had to happen. I just couldn't figure out, you know, the words to make that happen. So it's, you know, you're always sort of struggle with bouts of, you know, writer's block.
That's something I learned too. Kind of when I was going through, I just finished illustrating this full-length graphic novel, and I'd never done that before for another writer, just illustrated the whole thing. And I had to realize at some point during the beginning that if I was bored drawing it, everyone was going to be bored reading it. And that was like a big breakthrough for me. Like if I was just like, oh, if I could just get through this page and get on to the next one, it'll all be great. No, then everyone's going to hate it. Like I just have to find some way to make that interesting to me. Otherwise, it's just not even been a point to that page. So.
Well, it's actually a little after 3. So I think with that, we'll end the sort of formal group discussion. So I want to thank all the artists again. Thank all of you for coming. I really hope that we built this room. So thank you. The general turns over. We do still have this space. For a bit, we've got a cookie and some snacks out there. If you would like to stick around and see the artists, they've some of them brought their work to them, I guess, to sell. Please feel free. And again, if you came in late, the flyers that were on the chairs are passes for free admission to the small project. So please, take one. And I have a few extras. I'm not going to do anything with them. So if you know that you have somebody else who is actually going to go, come and talk to me and I will give you one. So thank you very much.
Yeah, I just. Oh, okay.
So, like, the last few years, everything was very happy.